information about immigrants' rights, free speech rights and protest rights, trans rights, as the rights of students in schools. Also, as I've stated before, I encourage people to go on our website and sign up for our email list so that you can receive our alerts. Because all of the work we do is very important, especially with our policy work. When our elected leaders are not representing us in the ways that we need them, we need to know about it to hold them accountable and to make sure that democracy works. And we will let you know the really important things to know, whether it's about immigrant and refugee rights, trans rights, protesters' rights, so that you can let our lawmakers know when you disagree with their actions or inactions. I also encourage people to go to our website and consider becoming a member. We have more than 52,000 people in Oregon who are members or donor supporters, because this is really a way that Oregonians make it possible for us to do the work of protecting democracy in our most vulnerable communities. And then last, I want to encourage people to sign up for emails from Oregon's Pro-Democracy Coalition, which is called Protect Oregon. And you can do this at their website, which is www.protect-oregon.com. And so if you sign up, their emails will actually give you specific things that you can engage in every week and month.
Sandy, thank you for all the work of ACLU and your team at ACLU Oregon. Thank you for being here. All the best. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Karen.
I've been speaking with Sandy Chung with ACLU Oregon. Thank you for listening.
Good morning. You have some gravy in your ear. This is Wavy Gravy, Temple of Accumulated Error and Voice of Woodstock, telling you you are listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM. The 90s are the 60s. Standing on your head. Yow!
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
1, 2, 3, 4. Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Song is Ball and Chain, and we let our guest this afternoon, who's written a wonderful book that we're going to go deep into, is called Why Billy Mae Thornton Matters. The song you heard was Ball and Chain by Big Mama Thornton, but the book is titled Willie Mae Thornton, so we're going to even talk about the whole concept of what Big Mama means and doesn't mean, but our guest this afternoon is not only an author, but a DJ who has serious chops, a scholar. You have a pretty big bio here. DJ Lene, Denise is our guest. So I'll give you your flowers. A global practitioner of sound language in Black Atlantic thought, is an Amsterdam-based writer and interdisciplinary artist from Los Angeles, California. Shaped by her parents' record collections in the 1980s, Denise's work traces the foregrounds, the intimacies of underground nightclub movements, music migrations, and bass culture in the African diaspora. She coined the term DJ scholarship in 2013, which explores how knowledge is gathered, interpreted, and produced through a conceptual and theoretical framework, shifting the role of the DJ from a party purveyor to an archivist and cultural worker. She's a doctoral student in the Department of Visual Culture at Goldsmiths University of London. And that's just the beginning. And she's been at the helm of many groundbreaking artistic and academic productions, including After the Last Dance, the first and only Michael Jackson conference with the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, the School of Prints with Los Angeles Public Library, and Aretha Franklin's Amazing Greats from Detroit to Watts, the first conference dedicated to solely chronicling the musical life of the Queen of Soul with the African, with the UCLA African American Studies Department, and now the author of the book Why Willie Mae, Big Mama Thornton Matters. Welcome to the show, Lynette, DJ Lynette. How you doing?
Thank you. Thank you so much, David D. I'm honored to be on this show. You are a living legend and critical thought, hip hop purveyor, scholar, community-based, deep listener, deep crate digging through the political history of hip hop and the Bay and Black life in general. So I'm honored to be in conversation with you.
I appreciate the props. What's your Venmo now?
Oh, come on now. Yes.
You know, listen, pay the lady, you know.
We agreed on a certain amount.
You know, that's my publicist out there, you know. No. Okay. We were talking just before we got on air. You know, asking you, respecting you as a DJ, if you could pick a song by Big Mama Thornton. We were going back and forth, and you said, you know, look at the Saved album. I have to admit, I knew Hound Dog and a couple other cuts, but I had not really dug deep into the catalog until I was reading this book. And I was like, oh, snap, I've been missing out. So, you know, I got to go and get all her stuff and add it to the repertoire because she's a beast, you know. She's a beast. And we picked Ball and Chain, but you were telling me a story about how she kind of introduces that song. And I thought maybe you might, we could start off and you could, off the cuff, share with us, you know, how she usually does this song, you know, in concerts when she was around. Because I think that kind of underscores the woman that we're talking about this afternoon.
That's a perfect place to start. Yeah, we chose Ball and Chain. Well, you know, for a number of reasons. First, you know, it's a song that was written in the Bay. So let's even give it this kind of, you know, Black musical geography's history and the context, right? Like, because it is through this song, Ball and Chain, that she wrote in 1961, that I came into contact with this archive of like Black owned blues labels in the Bay, right? So she recorded this song in 1961. And Janis Joplin heard her perform the song and proceeded to, you know, go backstage that night in San Francisco where she heard her perform Ball and Chain. And she asked permission along with her band to cover the song, and Willie Mae on the spot wrote on a napkin the lyrics to that song, and Janis Joplin in turn began to perform it. And with the Big Brother Holding Company, they performed it, I believe, at the Monterey Pop Festival. But of course, You know, Janis Joplin blew up with the song. Is a song that, yes, it is a song that Janis Joplin has become famous for. And so we'll get into some of the Elvis Presley history, obviously, with Hound Dog a little bit. But what was interesting about Ball and Chain, and just say the very basic and baseline difference between Janis Joplin and Elvis Presley, was that Janis Joplin constantly credited Willie Mae for writing the song and created a situation where she would get royalties for the song. And so there was a different balance, there was a different level of respect, different from Elvis and his camp, is what I'm saying. But still, because Willie Mae had dealt with the extreme blow to her career, right, of having Elvis sing the song Hound Dog, which she originally performs in 1952. I think Elvis Presley recorded it again in, I think, 1956, and he blows up. He, you know, this is one of the songs that keeps him rich until this day.
Right. Right?
And so because she was burned and she understood that the music industry, it's not about just like white cultural appropriation. It's actually about the political economy of Black music and the long, long history of Black artists being exploited, right? So this woman was a victim of the music industry's exploitive practices. And I want to be honest and say some of those folks who exploited her were the Black men who owned some of those labels, like Don Robey.
Right, you know, we got to talk about him. Yeah,
of course, people have stories about Berry Gordy. People have stories about probably like Master P. You know, whoever are running these labels and using these similar tactics, right? Because they've proven themselves to be, you know, successful tactics, getting publishing rights, And so, because she was burned, you know, every time she would introduce Ball and Chain, she would give you a little hint of shade to let you know that she was the original. Right. She did not place herself in a category of peers with Janis Joplin. So she would say something like, ladies and gentlemen, I wrote this song in 1961 and it was recorded by a young lady by the name of Janis Joplin. But I made this song and I made it famous. I wrote this song and I sing it the way I want it. Now, Janis may have sung it in the way she wanted, but I don't know nothing about that. What I know is that this is my song and this is how I perform it. And then, like, right on the one, the band would come in with the deep bass, you know? And so it was just a powerful anthem that gave her story more legs than the simple Elvis Presley stole her song moment.
Right. I think it's important to have that backdrop. And I say this because there's a generation disconnect, and one that erases important history. And I think I was just talking about this. I might have did it on the show, but it was somewhere else. I was talking about, we just did a thing on Ella Fitzgerald, right? And, you know, in her book, you know, she's like, you call me Ella Fitzgerald, Miss Fitzgerald. You know, she insists on that. There's a video going around that shows Maya Angelou, you know, Dr. Maya Angelou, chastising a young woman who just called her Maya. And there's a whole new generation of people. It's like, man, she's stuck up. Who does she think she is? And they're going off, right? Not really understanding. It's like, you know, all these titles and woo, 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 right? But when I'm reading, you know, the thing about Ella, there's a whole backdrop about how Black women were, in a pejorative way, called by their first name. So we don't call you Dr. DJ Lene Thompson. I just go, Lynette, what's going on? You know, and it's not done out of familiarity, but it's done out of a way like, I ain't going to call you no doctor. Like, I ain't going to call you Cash. I ain't going to call you Muhammad. Your mama called you Cash. So it's a way of putting you in your place. And
absolutely.
So there was an insistence, you know, for many generations, you know, including my mom and others, like, you call me by, you know, Miss Mom, but you don't call me by my first name. And the brothers, on the other hand, were like, you know, don't call me boy, you call me man. So there are these things about reclaiming language. And so what I thought was interesting, one, is to hear the backstory about how she's claiming her space, because if you don't, you completely get erased. And somebody might be listening who doesn't know the backstory and be like, man, what is she, egotistical? You know, what's going on? Not realizing, like, you know, you seriously got burnt. Even, you know, and there's, I don't know, there's, I hate to use the word trauma, but you just don't get over that. You don't get over that when you have your stuff, you know, taken and people are flossing and bossing and attributing you, you know, somebody else to your work. It's kind of like.
Absolutely.
So this kind of comes into, you know, one of the questions about Big Mama. You kind of put it in parentheses, but you talk about in the book. Mm-hmm. They have a whole chapter about the term Big Mama and what that means and why it wasn't always cool just to call her that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I want to make it clear, you know, because many of us Black folks have grandmothers that we refer to as Big Mama. Like, and we knew exactly what we meant, and we knew that that was a very serious term of respect and endearment, right? Yes. Like, Big Mama, you know, implies mother of the whole family. Big Mama is the safe space for, you know, me and all my cousins, my mother and her siblings, right? Yes. When you go to Big Mama's house, you are safe. But then there's another Big Mama that comes to mind when we place that word in the sort of collective imagination of white folks. You know, perhaps they are thinking of the quote-unquote Big Mamas who raised their children. Maybe they are thinking about the Big Mamas who cleaned their homes. It is not necessarily spoken with the same kind of respect.
It's a euphemism. It's a euphemism for mammy.
It's up there with mammy.
Yeah. It does come back to, because you point this out in the book as well, there are these communal languages, communication, spoken words, things that have deeper meaning. And we need to know that. And, you know, and I think you kind of lay that out, you know, as to what Big Mama meant, why it was important, and why, you know, you didn't start off with your title, Big Mama. It's in parentheses, so we know who you're talking about. But, and it, you know, why did she have to take that name? Because that seems also more like that was put on her, not because of a term of endearment, but just because she was a big woman, you know?
Yeah, so, yeah, and it's complicated, right? Because she also uses the term to refer to herself. And so I'm not shaming her or judging her. I'm asking my readers to consider this longstanding history of Black women being mammified, right? Yeah. And so, or even being limited to their size. Even if she was called Big Mama because of her size, there is a potential, you know, there's the potential threat of harm and ill will in that, because I don't care about her size the way that I care about her voice, the way that I care about how she writes lyrics, the way I care about how she plays the drums, the way I care about how she plays the harmonica. And so what happens when you place Big Mama out there as the primary title is, again, when it's coming through the hands of music journalists that are describing who she is, oftentimes those descriptive words are limited to things that point to her size and not her musicianship.
Yeah.
Right.
And
so
I didn't realize she was, I didn't realize she was that deep of a musician.
Deep musician, a drummer, a harmonic, like, listen, and, just an incredible talent.
Right. And I think when you have the term Big Mama without that understanding, you just think, well, you know, all these big women, they go to church and they sing, and you don't see the brilliance. Like, she produces, she writes her lyrics, she does all these different things. I want to get into some of the deeper things, but I want to kind of familiarize our audience. And, you know, if you could briefly give us a Willie Mae Thornton 101, you know, some highlights that either you point out in the book or highlights that we should absolutely know when we talk about her.
Okay. Yeah, it's important to know that this is a Black woman who was the child of the South. She was from Alabama. And this is a person whose mother died at an early age. which meant she had to be pulled out of school to care for her mother before she passed. And when her mother passed, her father, the then widow, wasn't able to care for all of the kids. And so Willie Mae had to take on odd jobs, domestic work in the 1930s, early 40s, until she comes across a woman by the name of Diamond Teeth Mary, who recognizes her, interestingly enough, because of her size, but also because of her voice. And Willie Mae had gotten a job on a garbage truck, throwing away garbage as a part of her living as a young woman, barely.
Was she a young woman? I was going to say she was a teenager when this is happening. Yeah. Right.
Yes. Yeah, she was a teenager. And so Diamond Teeth Mary, who was also a blues woman, was in town as a part of Sammy Green's Hot House Review, which was a review on the vaudeville circuit, let Willie Mae know that there was an audition for Sammy Green's review. And Willie Mae auditioned and she made it. And that was her ticket out of Alabama, or through Alabama, right? Because oftentimes with these vaudeville folks and reviews in the 1940s, they would tour the Black South, right? But they'd go to, Georgia, and not just Atlanta, but also Savannah, not just Savannah, but also Augusta, right? So she traveled throughout the South in these major cities and the smaller but major cities, and became acquainted with folks like Little Richard, who was also on the vaudeville circuit, and also Bessie Smith, who was reaching an older age, but always an influence to Willie Mae. And from there, Willie Mae hopped ship after being there for several years because of, money issues. And she went to Texas, and she eventually signed with, Don Robey, and
that was Peacock Records.
Peacock Records, owned by Don Robey, right?
Yeah.
Don Robey was the president, the owner of Peacock Records. But yes, thank you, Peacock Records. And Willie Mae becomes part of the kind of formation, I would argue, of rhythm and blues in Texas. During that time, she performed a lot of songs that were actually written by Don Robey, often songs referencing her weight, her size, her height. But she was most known for her super lively performances. So she stays at Peacock Records for years. She's moving between, all over Texas and performing, until eventually, still while signed to Don Robey's label, to Peacock Records, she is hooked up with Johnny Otis, who is
out of the Bay, Berkeley.
Yeah.
Right.
Berkeley. As a matter of fact, I'm going to speed this up and just talk about how, so these are key points where she hooks up with Johnny Otis, who is also the father of Shuggie Otis, Strawberry Letter 22, for those of you who may not know. He's from Berkeley. He's Greek, but he was like Black passing, and had his own review. And Willie Mae was part of that review as a part of Peacock Records, who he was also working with. Long story short, Don Robey essentially commissions him as a producer to work with Willie Mae. And Johnny Otis introduces Willie Mae to Stoller and Lieber, who are the original authors of Hound Dog. And they recorded that song in Johnny Otis's garage in 1951-52. And once it's recorded, I just want to let you know that even before it was recorded, Don Robey had publishing rights to Hound Dog. And Don Robey did not, right? And of course, Willie Mae did not. So, they write and record Hound Dog, and Don Robey puts it on the shelf. He releases it like two years later. It becomes a massive hit on Black radio in Black spaces. Right. And then 2 years later, it becomes, popularized by Elvis and his camp. And really, it's the song that set off, some would argue, his career. But I think what I want to tell your listeners is what is important is that is not where her story begins or ends, that she was performing for at least 15 years, for somewhere between 10 and 15 years before recording that song. And then she continues to perform like another 20 years after. So she has a 40-year body of work that needs our time and energy and attention. And she you know, moved from Alabama to Texas, from Texas to Cali. She toured Europe as a part of the American, you know, folk blues festival.
And had an influence there. And this, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with author DJ. I'm going to put that DJ there because that's what you get busy with. Lene Denise. She's also a scholar and has her chops in all these things. But I think it's important as a DJ because you even make note that you're approaching the writing of this book with that in mind. And so the way that you're weaving the information in and out, it's almost like, you know, like if you're doing a set at a party. And so I think people will enjoy reading that in that manner. With that being said, you spend a lot of time, or you spend at least a good chapter talking about the Alabama roots. And I want to go back to that because I have a lot of conversations with folks and two cities come up as jump off. Atlanta is an obvious one. So that's like now the Black Mecca. But if you talk to somebody like David Banner, he will give you a whole history list of everybody who has a relative or an uncle or aunt from Mississippi and claimed them. And I have a conversation that you do know Nate Dogg's people were from Mississippi. Like, okay, you know Snoop's people from Mississippi. And he goes on and on. And you too, right? Mississippi roots. And of course, we look at Mississippi, then we start talking about the Delta Blues and we start talking about all this talent that, you know, people argue was in the soil and in the air. But you kind of give the treatment of Alabama, and I didn't realize Alabama had a lot of flavor. You said it's a funky city. So let's share a little bit about Alabama's roots, where Willie Mae comes out of. And, you know, there are some folks that can go head-to-head with Mississippi.
Oh, for sure. I mean, yeah, breaking down that chapter was fun. I mean, and, you know, thinking about the fact that John Coltrane is from Alabama. Sun Ra is from Alabama. Michael Jackson's people, you know, as in Katherine Jackson, is from Alabama. Stevie Wonder's mother is from Alabama. Angela Davis is from Alabama, right? Willie Mae Thornton is from Alabama. So, you know, I mean, yes, what I talked about was the fact that we have to reckon with the funk in the soil of Alabama. Because if Alabama is out here giving birth to Sun Ra and Angela Davis, you know, like, and perhaps if Alabama is the place that ignited so much hatred for Black people that these four little girls were bombed in an Alabama church. If Alabama is so, you know, white Alabamans in particular are so concerned about revenge that they create these like Black codes that would make it illegal for Black folks to play their drums, to sing in public, to gather in more than two or three, you know, groups of or people of three, right? So,
and this is during slavery and post-slavery.
This is during slavery and post-slavery. And quite honestly, it could be argued that it happens now, right? Yeah. What happens when cops see three or more Black people, you know, in certain areas and how they become policed for being more than two people sharing a space at the same time. So I had to deal with, like, you know, Alabama's violent history, its plantation history, its history of lynching. But I really want to pay attention to why white folks have been historically afraid to the point of violence of Black music.
Yeah.
And Alabama is one of those places where those laws began, right? Where Black music was policed and monitored and deemed, you know, illegal and criminal. That's one aspect of it.
Yeah.
But let me just wrap this up and say the other aspect of it is that Black folks ourselves, our complicated relationship with the South, particularly those of us whose people come from Mississippi and Alabama, and then, though, you know, people move and migrate to the bigger cities, bigger states, California, my people, you know, Chicago, New York. But what happens is the further we are from those Southern roots, the more kind of pretentious we become, right? And we kind of associate the Black South with being a place that's backwards, which is what I write about.
Yeah.
And how we used to refer to weed as, you know, if you had good weed, it was Indo. And if you had, you know, poor quality weed, it was called Bama, right? Mm-hmm. That we would critique the Southern accents. And then I was like, hold on. Snoop has a Southern accent. Gangster right. rappers have Southern accents. You know, like, why is that? And then you begin to do that music mapping and that tracing, and you remember something that Mary Baraka said, which is that, you know, the Black South is like the Black American country. It's the motherland
right.
for Black Americans.
And also, you know, what is also pointed out, you point out, is that each state have its own sound and its own vibe. So New Orleans is its own country. I mean, you know, I mean, Louisiana, but within that, New Orleans and Baton Rouge and all those places, but you step in there, it's like going to a whole country. And you go into Mississippi, and I think many of us are now familiar because there's been so much advocacy around that. It's its own thing.
Totally.
Same thing with Georgia. You know, there's so much that we now know it. Texas, of course, have its mm-hmm. own, you know, we know that that's a that has a lot of history, you know, when you mm-hmm. look at that. But then Alabama was one of those places that you just, as you said, it was almost a pejorative, you know, you're Bama mm-hmm. in DC, you're Bama weed, mm-hmm. all that. But mm-hmm. but you, as you were pointing out, the richness of it, one of the things that stood out, and I didn't realize, and you've mentioned it earlier, is that Willie Mae Thornton played instruments. You know, play drums, but I didn't know she was friends with Stevie, and he was the one that got her the harmonica and got into that.
I understand how you thought. Yeah, no, what I was saying in that is that I came into and I was introduced to the harmonica through Stevie Wonder, right?
Okay.
And because I am born in 1975 in Los Angeles, California, where like I didn't grow up on the blues at all. Even though my grandmother was listening to like, you know, Coco Taylor and Johnny B. Just different folks. Yeah. I just associated with old music, older people's music. I was listening to hip hop and soul and funk. I didn't have no time for blues, right? But what I was saying was that, you know, I think about Stevie Wonder on Do I Do, right? And just Stevie Wonder in the 80s having the harmonica. That's my context. My context is not the blues, but it's in fact harmonica. But Willie Mae's brother gave her
the
harmonica.
Okay.
That's okay. Yeah, but it's a lot in these chapters. A lot. Right. There's a lot of layers. So I understand how you misread that.
But still, she had that. And you point out that she's not allowed to play it on her records for so long. What was that yeah. about?
I mean, it's probably connected to the very same reasons why we consider people like Roberta Flack, Aretha Franklin, and Nina Simone and Sarah Vaughan to be singers when they're actually accomplished pianists, some of them multi-instrumentalists, right? We are much more comfortable with women being accessories to music through the voice. That women's role in music is to be singers, right? To not write. So even when we talk about Alice Coltrane, right? We talk about her as John's wife. We don't talk about Alice Coltrane as a multi-instrumentalist who plays the harp, who plays piano, who plays synthesizers, right? Like she was also an electronic musician. So yeah, you know, Bobby Humphrey on the flute, you know, right. We're talking about Rosetta
would
Thorpe
Abby,
on the
would
guitar.
Abby, would Abby Lincoln fall into that as well?
Oh, you know why I really appreciate you is because I've been listening to Abby Lincoln and Max Roach for the past three days. I am not familiar with Abby's work enough to know that she played physical instruments in addition to her voice, which she absolutely played as an instrument. Did right. she play any other instruments?
That I don't know. That's what I'm asking.
But that's a powerful question though, just because her voice does more than sing. You right. know,
like Ella Fitzgerald, so, you know.
Totally. Yes, yeah. Betty Carter, who's Betty scanning Carter, yeah. and get Yeah, so oh yeah, and let me be clear that even if you are just a quote unquote just a singer, you are an instrumentalist, you are a musician, right? And so even if Aretha and Roberta and these women didn't play piano and harp and these other things, they'd still be musicians. But my point is that Black women are not read as and represented as, you know, masterful musicians. And so, yeah, Willie Mae was discouraged from playing the flute until she signed, you know, or until she recorded that first album in London, right? And another Bay Area, Chris, right. can't remember his name. Yes, but yes.
How much of limiting the role of women, Black women in this case, to just being quote unquote singers had to do with respectability politics and marketing and defined gender roles? And those are things that you talk about a lot in the book as well.
Mm-hmm. No, good question. Yeah, a lot of it was about marketing because it says something about a patriarchal culture that prefers that women be in supporting roles, and that is extended to music, that women are there to support male producers and musicians, right? And so I guess that's why we need and love people like Lauryn Hill.
Right, but that's such a... okay, so the way I've seen it, and I think you said it and others have pointed out, maybe with Angela Davis as well, you know, it was these women that record like the first blues. Your Ma yes. Rainey's, your Bessie Smith, right?
Yes. Yes.
Who's the other? There's a few others, I'll think of them. Mm-hmm. But these are bigger than life figures. They kind of define a kick in the doors.
Yes.
And I, in my mind, I see Willie Mae Thornton as an extension of that, you know, of kicking in doors and being, you know, that powerful presence in that regard. And so one would think that if you understand that, then let's expand upon it. And there is no room to expand. You know, you're seeing the stories behind the scenes, like you said, the Don Robbie's are like, now you're not playing on this thing. You're not going to play on this album. So it just, I don't know. It seems like that there's an erasing from the jump. There's a limitation from the jump. And I don't know if it's ever really been reconciled until people like yourself are writing these books and you're going, I didn't know, because I didn't know, you know,
yeah,
all this stuff.
We don't know. Yeah. No, we have to dig, right? And so part of it is you hope that you have the willingness to take women's lives serious enough to be curious about those lives. Yeah. How about how curiosity is one way that we can protect the honor of these women, right? And that's the curiosity that Angela Davis had when she wrote the book Blues Legacies and Black Feminism, right? Which you know, and I know that you were just referencing that, was a major sort of guide in me writing this book. Cause I'm like, yo, I'm a B-girl from LA, born in 1975, grew up on, you know, everybody from you know, Rick Rubin. That's interesting that I named him first. But I was just thinking of Def Jam and the fact that Beastie Boys was my first album, knew every Public Enemy album verbatim, grew up, right. I'm talking about Gangstar, Poor Righteous Teachers, Main Source, these are my, I had no relationship to the blues, even though we know folks like Premier and different folks were like sampling the blues, it was very distant. So I think like I had to have curiosity, but I needed a guide, like who is someone who kind of like has nothing to do with the blues, who seemingly has nothing to do with the blues or even music, and then they write this book. And it was Angela Davis, because she came out with a book about music. People were confused. But why? Right. You know, like, actually, part of her revolutionary acts are about loving Black people, certainly beyond their trauma, right? And so she taught me and she modeled what it meant to care for these Black women. And to help me come up with a line of questions in that care, and also to help me learn how to listen to those Black women closely beyond their songs but to kind of listen between the lines of their lives to figure out who they were.
I mentioned that she comes out of a line of women, and you know, the queerness, gender nonconforming within that, you know, the Ma Rainey's, Bessie's, and all that. Mm-hmm. You also, you know, bring into the conversation Little Richard and others. Let's mm-hmm. talk a little bit about that. Obviously, the people that I just named are major, major contributors, you know, to, you know, various genres of music, and they're all around the same time. But you're also, you know, 1930s, 1940s are living in a world that is very intolerant, even though these folks, and you know, even Little Richard talks about, I want to say Billy Wright, I guess was the name, or
yeah,
Bobby Wright,
exactly.
You know, and others, you know, who are very flamboyant and out there, right? Today we see the flamboyancy of some artists and we kind of take it for granted or even have it expected. So, you know, it's like, well, you got to put on these crazy outfits and go out there. But when they did it, you know, how much of it was just seen as them being performance versus just expression that is groundbreaking, that, you know, brought a lot of things into question, like, why are you wearing a pompadour? Why do you want to wear overalls? In fact, with Willie Mae Thornton, I didn't realize that she was always dressing in overalls and pants, because the picture that I always associate her with is with her wearing a dress which she didn't like wearing, you know, most of the time.
Precisely. Right. Yeah. I mean, that thin line in Black life between performance and expression, right? It's a thin, thin line. I mean, I have no idea. I can't even imagine who Little Richard was outside of his makeup and full-fledged, you know, I was going to call it a costume, but I don't know, but that complicates the word costume, right. But that's just because it's so authentic in the presentation / performance that it truly blurs the line. You forget that these are people who are, we know them on stage. We know mm-hmm. them on stage. And I guess the recent documentary about Little Richard and learning about his struggles and, you know, and all these folks who struggle with addiction. And like, you realize that the Black public performance face versus the Black private face and the thin line between the two, when you consider, say, for example, someone like Whitney Houston's public, you know, sort of downfall. And to go from this like spectacular career to a like hyper sensationalized fall is sadly the trajectory for so many Black artists, right? To the point where like, I don't know what is performance. I don't know what, it, you know, on the one hand, Whitney Houston was like prevented from publicly acknowledging her bisexuality, right? Or, and on the other hand, someone like Luther Vandross isn't flamboyant at all. But, you know, he was sort of brought out, he was sort of, you know, his sexuality was declared after he passed. It wasn't right. something he was wearing. But anyway, I feel like that's a long-winded answer. But what I'm talking about is just that, like, ultimately, one thing I've been really thinking about is like, the fact that Willie Mae Thornton, for example, yes, wore overalls, wore cowboy hats, wore cowboy boots, hated wearing dresses, would sometimes refuse to wear the dress, would have the record company buy the dress, and she would show up on stage with the overalls instead. Like, that we really, you know, have to fight for privacy. And Willie Mae never, ever, ever admit it and share that she was lesbian or gay or queer.
Right. As you were talking, DJ Lene Denise, who's our guest, author of the book, Why Willie Mae, Big Mama Thornton Matters. You know, for Black folks, for us as Black folks, one of the ways in which we were able to find a sense of our humanity and be authentic was through these expressions through song and dance, right? Where we were allowed to do it. Maybe couldn't play the drums, but we would sing the hell out of a song, right? And then when you look at the functionality of music, you understand that music serves a variety of purposes, you know, in the African diaspora, more than just the commodity. I think oftentimes we look at it as a commodity and realize, well, if she's singing, I'm singing too. You know, she's singing, I'm dancing. If you DJ and I'm getting, you know, we all, it's a participatory thing, and we find ourselves and lose ourselves within those expressions. And that's how maybe we collectively have had to respond to oppression, you know, based upon race. You know, I can't really be myself, but I'm going to sing this song and you're going to feel it. You might even fear it, you know, because of the way I'm bringing it across, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But if you scale it down, maybe Little Richard, if he's struggling with, you know, who he is sexually speaking, he's going to lose himself in the pompadour and, you know, in the crazy lyrics. And I'm wondering if we're seeing some of that with some of those artists, you know, like I'll go extra hard, but I'm doing this because this is the only space that I can be myself. Would that apply there? You see?
Yeah, I appreciate that reading of it. You know, like literally a kind of getting in where you fit in. Like it's literally that expression embodied. Yes, I fully agree that like folks had to find pieces of themselves in a world that demanded their hyper visibility.
Hmm.
Being
and that visibility and that visibility had to be confined to boxes. Otherwise, you was in danger.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. And also in the face of a kind of invisibility, because all you get reduced to is that of a performer, that of a person who entertains, or even a thing that entertains, right? Like, or, you know, so this is coming from the fact that I often think about, you know, again, the plantation model that the music industry replicates and this idea of Black labor and white wealth.
Yeah.
The hyper performance, the hyper visibility creates a kind of invisibility.
One of the things I appreciate that you did in the book, I mean, obviously it's focusing on Willie Mae Thornton, but you also parallel a lot of other things and you give us a good view of what's going on. I was always curious about Don Robey, right? The owner of Peacock Records.
Mm-hmm.
We often hear of Barry Gordy, right? Mm-hmm. To a lesser degree, Chess Records wouldn't count in that, but you know, this was a powerful figure, you know, who owned a lot of stuff. And you know, when I first heard about Peacock Records, I was like, oh wow, this is like maybe even something. Well, it predates Motown. Right.
Mm-hmm,
it exists before Motown, and this is a guy that owns taxi cab companies and he's running things. And then you hear the craziness, like, oh snap, this dude is like a Suge Knight figure before Suge Knight, and maybe even worse. Can we talk a little bit about that? Because here Willie Mae Thornton is signed to a label where the owner, you know, beat the hell out of Little Richard, you know, was known for that, you know, like he was the guy that might have been the prototype of dangling people over, you know, balconies and doing all these things. And what's crazy is that this is happening in the Jim Crow South. And this is a successful businessman who, I think you pointed out, mimicked the rough and tumbleness of the music industry, where some of the things I just described also went on the white side of town, and oftentimes, sadly, with Black artists. So let's talk a little bit about Don Robey and the relationship that Willie Mae Thornton had with him, because he didn't really step to her. He stepped to everybody else, but he let her be.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to know that she also had part-time jobs as a security guard.
She did.
You know, like... Yeah. But I talk about it in the book, or like she would be, you know, a little bit in the book, and just like maybe a sentence where I just talk about like what she did, you know, for extra money, shiny shoes,
right?
You know, security, but also that she was known to physically attack promoters who attempted to cheat her.
Yeah.
Right? That she was arrested multiple times. Yes, because of her height. You know, she talked about carrying you know, a weapon of protection. This yeah. was not a woman to be played with, you know. And who comes to mind for me is someone like Della Reese's character in Harlem Nights, even okay. though Big Mama Thornton slash Willie Mae was, or rather Willie Mae slash Big Mama, wasn't feminine like Della Reese. There's a way that Della Reese was treated by the male characters, by the Eddie Murphys, by the Red Foxes, that let you know that she was a peer and also not someone to play with. You don't come for, you know, you don't come for her. So right. Willie Mae, you know, had that stature. Yeah, her size mattered in the context of not being as intimidated by folks like Don Robey. Don Robey was a white passing, you know, successful businessman who owned multiple sort of like, you know, enterprises before eventually investing in a club. And once he invested in the club, he would, you know, he made a name for that club, which was like a middle black middle class Texan, you know, performance space, and decided to enter the music industry. But I think what's really important about Don Robey, absolutely, he was a bully. Absolutely, he exploited the artists. Marie Adams was one of those artists, you know, Clarence Gatemouth Brown, like a number of artists, you know. But I think what's really interesting is that he worked with a woman as his partner, not his yeah. romantic one, but his business partner. And her name was Evelyn Johnson.
Yeah.
Also from Texas, right? And so Evelyn Johnson and Don Robey played a role in creating the infrastructure that made the Chitlin Circuit possible, right? And by infrastructure, I mean creating a kind of legal network that made it possible for the artists that were on their labels to move through the South, right? And
that's
what
I found. And that's what I found brilliant, you know, about that. Yeah. And thanks for bringing up Evelyn. I had her name in the top of the thing.
Yeah.
Because you talk about she went out and got licenses, and it allowed her to do some things that were kind of groundbreaking at that time, right? So she could book
yeah.
shows and things like that. I think some of the things that are mentioned, we kind of take for granted and don't realize, like, you just couldn't get up there and just do any old thing. Even when some people kind of, you know, romanticize about, well, if we just stop integrating and do for self. Yeah, but you still had to go and engage folks in order to have a nightclub. Yeah,
absolutely.
You had to engage the power structure to actually book these acts. You know, yes. you had to have these cabaret things, you know, in order to just exist, you know, and mm-hmm. And so I think we kind of forget about that. And they were doing that, as you described. And I thought that was a side note, you know, mm-hmm. in the book, but an important one to yeah. give it fuller context. So.
Mm-hmm. No, thank you for reading that closely. That's exactly what I meant. And yeah, what do we mean when we say Black music? Just like the question of what do we mean when we say Black film, and is it Black if your only options to distribute it is through major white companies and labels, or who is responsible for marketing and framing, you know, the nature of that music? Who gets paid to make it possible for the artist to tour, and all of those things? And so the fact that Evelyn Johnson and Don Robey had this brilliant master plan, you know, to kind of keep it as Black as possible. I think what's also interesting is the number of white folks that would try to attend these yeah. Black spaces, right? But yeah, they created a situation where like they were essentially independent.
Right, but at the same time, is it Black if you're exploiting Black in the same manner as yeah. white? Yeah,
no, that's
and that becomes a complicated thing too. It's like I love the story of Don Robey. At the same time, I'm like, damn, like why were you this type of person? And then sometimes we can justify it if we're in the music industry. Well, you know, the rough and tumble business, and that's just how they do it. And they did it on that side of town, and we did it on this side of town, but. Is it liberation when you're just replicating
no.
systems of oppression?
Absolutely not. It is absolutely not liberation. And it's, you know, aspirational by every sense of the word. I use the word aspirational because I'm thinking about Berry Gordy, And the number of women in particular who had a very, very hard time with the fact that Motown kept so much of the publishing, also the production with the in-house, you know, Funk Brothers and all of this, like, you know, Berry Gordy, I think, escapes a kind of critical scrutiny around how he used those same exploitive practices, perhaps because of the respectability, right? The squeaky clean nature that Motown has versus like a Don Robey who's working with, like, you know, the gritty blues men like Clarence Gatemount Brown, and even like the, like, you know, Willie Mae was like gangster, and she was grimy in terms of, you know, I'm using grimy in this kind of, you know, black slang context to say, like, fearless and not on that Motown, you know, middle class aspiration.
Gritty be the word?
Gritty
versus grimy.
Gritty. Well, I'm using grimy thinking about the UK context.
Okay.
The black UK context.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
Like, you know, just a kind of global description of a kind of black power in the swag.
Right.
And a kind of fearlessness, right? Grimy, gritty, gangster, but like, you know, but anyway, let me just say but I think ultimately, yeah, yes, we watch these amazing black labels, you know, like Peacock Record and Motown, but we watch black people suffer under the hands of other black people, you know? So no, liberation, no. A kind of model that I hope can be, you know, redesigned with similar visions, yes. But as is, no. Those are not liberatory spaces.
We've been talking with DJ Lene Denise, author of the book Why Willie Mae, Big Mama Thornton Matters. And I appreciate you. Appreciate the book. And you got anything coming out next? There's going to be a movie or anything?
No, I would hope. Hey, I hope somebody reaches out to me about a movie. That'd be amazing. Hey, if anyone's out there, you know, no, but no, I'm just working on this PhD. And then, yeah, I'm thinking about my next book, and it will be about black women musicians. So stay tuned.
Right. Because we could have talked about Prince. I forgot you did that. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a whole lot of other things. We might have to have you come back on to go deep into, you know,
I would
the purple
love
one.
To.
Yeah. Okay.
I would love to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's my guy idea. You know, I won't show my purple print shoes that nobody has.
Ooh.
You know.
Oh, you're one of those, like a real, okay. Yep. Like
yeah, we do our Prince parties and all that up here.
Oh,
you know?
Love it. I love it. I love it. I would love to come back and talk Prince with you. Absolutely.
Okay. There we
Let's
have
think
it.
About that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio, folks. We will be right back.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Been snooping around my door. You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Been snooping around my door. You can wag your tail, but I ain't gonna feed you no more. You told me you was high class, but I can see through. You told me you was hot, man, but I just see through that. And daddy, I know you ain't no real cool cat. You ain't nothing but a hound dog been snooping around my door. You just a hound dog been snooping around my door. You can wag your tail, oh.
question, just imitation, simulation, step into the zone, the Bay Area zone, Hard Knock Radio, let's go. Big shout out to Nita and Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kinda crazy though. Oakland stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bellevue. Yeah. Come on.
Check out.
Why it be obvious if they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee? Hating that they made they beats trying to eat till it ain't from the steel grave beef. Say please. I'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making his peace. Say you peace to the lovers, our neighbor to please. Hey, there's some shade on your name in the street. Let's go. Hey, it ain't David G.
Real Talk Radio.
You and I rocking with the best in the West.
Yes, Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
Let's go.
Now, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. You don't know.
Is autism an epidemic? Or is it a superpower? Are you a little bit on the spectrum? Or are you hashtag actually autistic?